The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Is the Peter Boyle Show.
It is. We are. And one more time, everyone. Good morning. It's in the 8 o'clock on a Thursday, the 12th morning of November, 2020. Good old 710 KNUS, Denver's talk station. And our weather center weather, 45 the high today, 57 Friday, and 58 degrees on Saturday. Without further ado, we met him on a book, months ago, and I just fell in love with his work. And his name is Lou Paper. He's a historian. And I said, well, send me your other books. And each and every time he does, and each and every one we read, and each and every time he comes on a radio show. And about 4 or 5 days ago, I finished Empire, his book on William Paley and the making of CBS. Please say good morning. Welcome back, historian Lou Paper. Hey, Lou, thanks for doing the show again, and welcome back.
Hey, well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, you're great. I mentioned to our last guest, I was sent a book after we did Perfect, which was your baseball book on Don Larsen in the 56 World Series. A guy sends me a book about Ty Cobb and Babe Ruth. And I'm reading it right now about the relationships between those guys. And it's in an era, of course, prior to what you focused on. But again, it's all the stuff that you don't know. And that's what makes it so intriguing for somebody like me. And swinging into Empire and Paley, you actually, at the end of the book, you actually meet William Paley. And
right.
Talk about William Paley, then pick up meeting him, what it was like.
Well, I had, let's take a step back. So Bill Paley founded CBS in 1927 when he was a young boy, or 1928. And it was a struggling radio empire, a chain of radio stations that was not doing very well. And he picked it up because he was fascinated by radio, and his family was in the cigar business. And then he took that, and his family was very wealthy, and he took the money from his family, and he built that into CBS, which obviously had radio stations and television stations, but also expanded into other areas as well. So anyhow, in doing this book, he was really one of the foremost people in the history of broadcasting, before the advent of cable. And so I thought it would be interesting to provide a biography of him. At the time, this was in the 1980s, the only biography of him was a book he had written, which was not entirely accurate or deep. And so I spent a long time doing research. I talked to him on the phone many times. And I talked to his staff many times. He was a little reluctant, but at the same time, he wanted to make sure that I had information that he thought would present his perspective on things. And then finally, as I was getting finished with the book, he called up and said he wanted to meet with me. And so I went to his office in what they call Black Rock, which is on 52nd Street in Manhattan. And I went up to one of the higher floors on Manhattan, and I walked in, and a beautiful woman escorted me into his private dining room. And he came in, and we sat there, and we had lunch. And I was there for about 2 or 3 hours, obviously eating and talking, and mostly talking. And he was very charming. That was one of his great attributes. Mm-hmm. He was a very charming guy. Even at this point, he was in his 80s, his mid-80s when I saw him. And so, but he was still chairman of the company. He wasn't CEO anymore, but he was chairman. But he was a very interesting guy, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so drawn to this, and I'm reading a book now entitled "Traitor to His Class," a new biography of FDR, and I'm an FDR fan, and you have this point in the book, and I was telling another historian, William Paley made FDR your neighborhood friend because of radio and the fireside chats. I thought that was so brilliant, Lou, because I've listened to fireside chats, and my grandma was a big FDR fan and loved FDR, and my family loved FDR. You know, they were working class Democrats, and but that line that you came up with, that was that changed everything in my thinking. He made FDR your neighbor, made FDR your friend through radio. Pursue that if you would.
Well, here's the irony about this. So here's Bill Paley. He was a young guy in the 30s, in his 30s, in the 1930s. He was born in 1901, so he was in his 30s. And NBC, which was owned by RCA, that was the premier radio network in the country. And so Bill Paley was trying to build up his rival network at CBS, and they couldn't get advertising for a lot of the time. And so what they would do is they would have what they call sustaining programming, which was really what I would say public interest programming, program where there was no advertiser because they needed to fill the time. And so what they did is they put a lot of programs on that focused on news and things like that. That's how Edward R. Murrow got his start. Edward R. Murrow got his start on the sustaining programs where they couldn't find an advertiser. And that's how CBS, in a way, became the leader in the news front. And, of course, one of the things they did, as you mentioned, was to give President Roosevelt an opportunity to speak over the radio. There was no TV at the time. And, of course, this was a new invention, and no president before Roosevelt had done this. And for millions and millions of Americans across the country to be sitting in your living room or dining room, wherever your radio was, and to hear the president's voice and hear him talking to you as though he was right there with you was really an incredible event, and people treasured that.
Oh.
And, of course, that's what led to Roosevelt's popularity in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I love that line that he made the president your neighbor and your friend, and I'm paraphrasing your work, but that stuck with me. I think Donald Trump tried to do that with tweets using the Internet. Jimmy Carter failed at it when he put the sweater on and – Eisenhower, I don't think, was the kind of guy that could do it. Nixon certainly wasn't. But FDR, I mean, it's that moment, and you've written about all these different aspects, but these people that begin to understand the media, through Joseph Goebbels, Adolf Hitler really understood the media.
For sure.
Winston Churchill.
Absolutely.
Winston Churchill, my God. And FDR.
Right.
And that was about it. Those three men.
You got to remember, this is the age of electronic media.
Yeah.
This was entirely new. And for people, as I say, they could read about him in the newspapers, but he was, in a way, almost like a fictional figure because you could see pictures of him, you could read about him. But to have actually hear him talk was a new experience. Mm-hmm. And more than that, Roosevelt, unlike many presidents, could sit there and he tried always to describe things in ways that other people could understand. I think one of the best examples was when he tried to explain to the American public.
Lend-lease.
Why?
Yeah.
Pardon?
Lend-lease was one.
Exactly. I was going to say. He gave this example when he was talking about Lend-Lease, and here was Britain being overwhelmed by the Nazi blitzkrieg of planes coming over and bombing them, and Churchill was saying we need destroyers. They wanted 50 old destroyers that the United States had. And so what Roosevelt did was he said, well, if your neighbor's house is burning down, and he says, I need a hose, you don't say to him, well, make me an offer and I'll sell you my hose. you loan it to him so that he can use it to put out the fire. And that's what we're doing here. We're giving Great Britain a hose to help put out the fire that's been created by the Nazis. So that was one way in which Roosevelt tried to explain his policies in terms that everybody could understand from their own common experience.
Yeah. I mean, he's brilliant. And, of course, you know, evil can be a genius, but Joseph Goebbels, he understood movies. He understood they seized the newspapers. We were talking to somebody the other morning. The first people to go in Dachau were the newspaper editors who opposed Hitler. And they I mean, Winston Churchill, what a magnificent command of radio. And this was in this era.
Yeah.
Man, in this era. Let's talk to that, if you would.
Well, you know, it's like anything. I want to say this, that radio and television and now social media, and the social media has really just expanded mm-hmm. the scope of and reach of what I would call electronic media. And so it's in and of itself, it's a neutral device. It can be used mm-hmm. for good
yeah.
or evil. As
yeah.
you point out, Roosevelt, as we were just discussing, used it to advance purposes that most of us would agree were for good purposes. Mm-hmm. But Goebbels and Hitler used it for evil purposes. And that's because electronic media could overwhelm everything, and
yes.
it could overwhelm the printed media. And so if you take, in the case of the Nazis, they just kept using electronic media to repeat lies over and over mm-hmm. and over again, so that when Hitler first came to power in 1933, they would constantly tell the German populace that the cause of their problems, they were suffering from the Depression, mm-hmm. they had suffered a humiliating defeat in World War I, and they kept saying that the source of your problems are the Jews. Mm-hmm. And they kept repeating it over and over and over again, despite the lack of evidence to support it. But because they kept repeating it over and over again, you know, reasonable people, good people in Germany, they kept hearing it so often that after hearing it for a year, 2 years, 3 years, they began to believe it.
And?
Not because it was true, but because they just heard it so often, it just finally sunk into their consciousness. And so when the trucks pulled up, they grabbed Jews from their apartments or houses and take them away in trucks, people would say, well, they got what they deserved mm-hmm. because they had accepted all these lies that had been repeated day after day for years over German radio.
And they eliminated any opposition. That,
correct.
You know, Colonel McCormick and FDR, you know, his newspapers, that was a huge clash. The American Firsters and Lindbergh and Bora and all those guys that were the American Firsters, they had a voice against FDR.
But that's a good point to keep in mind, is that in contrast to Germany, where no one had access to radio.
Nobody.
Right? But in the United States, even though, as we said, Roosevelt could use it for purposes to advance his policy goals, other people also had access to radio. And so people would hear, like Lindbergh. Mm-hmm. They could hear Charles Lindbergh or other people who mm-hmm. were opposed to Roosevelt's policy.
Father Coughlin.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you have people, and so that's what made America strong, because mm-hmm. people had, there was equal access. So mm-hmm.
No, I agree. It's one of my fears now of the diminishing of talk radio, because it is an opposition voice. But, you know, and I mean, all of these things, the dynamics are so powerful. Our guest is Lou Paper. I'm a big fan. This is like his fourth book, I think, I've read, Empire. But in the middle of all of this insanity comes the one and only Edward R. Murrow. And how does Murrow know Paley? And what Murrow did, and there was a book called Murrow's Boys. I read it years ago about all these guys that came out of Murrow. Talk about that.
Well, Edward R. Murrow came. He actually, as I mentioned before, he came on one of these sustaining programs that was really educational in nature, and then he shifted to the news. And then what happened was when World War II started, Murrow was sent to England, and he was based in London. And so this was a time when the United States was before Pearl Harbor, and so the United States was technically not at war with anybody. And although, but the United States was very sympathetic, obviously, to England, and we were providing, as we discussed before, lend lease, we were providing aid to England. But what Murrow would do is they would provide, through the radio, they would try to provide the American people with some real-life insight into what it was like. And so during the Blitzkrieg, when German planes were coming over and bombing London, he would go up to the top of apartment buildings in London and describe what he was seeing as the German planes were dropping bombs over London. Yeah. And, of course, here back in the United States, people were listening to somebody from CBS describing in vivid detail what it was like to be living in a city that was being bombed to smithereens.
Yeah, wow.
And so that had that's what made CBS. CBS became, unlike NBC, CBS became the champion of news.
Yep.
And in addition to Murrow, Murrow had a lot of other journalists who worked with him. You refer to them as Murrow's boys, but these guys also did similar things and provided reports on the radio about what it was like first to be in England when Germany was attacking England, and then, of course, as the war moved to the continent in Europe, they would provide reports of what was going on there.
A highlight in my life is I got to speak with Shire. And
oh, yeah, he was one of them.
Oh,
so William Shire was one of the people who was one of Morrow's boys who reported on Germany. He was based in Berlin.
He was there. That's right. And
go ahead.
A year ago in October, I got to take I don't know if it was a vacation, more of just of seeing the rise and fall of the Nazis. And one of the places that I got to go to was Zeppelin Field, where the rallies took place. And and I remember, it was years ago, I was a young kid in the business, and Shire was always on the outs with everybody. He really was the rebel with the cause, but I was in awe of him, and we talked about it. And then he's when, I think it's in your book, and I get tangled up in books, but when the Germans roll into Austria, then they grab all the Austrian radio. They grab all the stations, and they take Austrian radio down. And reading the history of revolution, especially Third World, wars of national liberation, the first thing they do is seize the radio station, especially in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s. And the Germans do it in Austria, and Shire sees it. And he knows. He knows it's going to happen. What a brilliant guy.
Right.
I mean, what a brilliant guy.
Right. I should mention, by the way, for your listeners, that if they're interested in my book about Bill Paley or my other books about Pearl Harbor or whatever, they can go to my website, Lew Paper, LEWPAPER, lewpaper.com.
I should have done that.
And there's, that's okay. There's reviews and there's photographs and sometimes videos that they might find interesting. But to your point about radio, about the Germans and Goebbels and Hitler, they understood the power of radio. And I think that really presages what's going on even today, because social media, it used to be it was radio, then it was television, and now it's social media. The importance of electronic media in shaping people's views about their leaders and the issues that surround them.
Yeah, I went into this museum. There's so many, if you're with a good guy that knows what they're talking about. And there was the Nazi radio. They have one. Or I'm sure there's more than one. But they used to call them cathedral radios. And there it is. And there's a painting, part of the propaganda. And there's an elderly man and a young, and this is his family. And everyone's sitting in a Bavarian costumed. It's called Listening to the Führer. And actually, they more listen to Joseph Goebbels than they listen to the Führer, and how indoctrinating that is. And they made sure that everybody had a radio.
Well, especially because in countries like that, like you were saying, what the Nazis understood was not only the importance of radio, but given the importance of radio, making sure that there were no opposing voices on
Indeed.
The radio. So they not
Indeed.
Only seized it, they made sure that nobody else had access to it.
Yeah.
And that was scary. So the only voice that people in Austria and Germany and everywhere that the Germans went, the only voice they heard
was
the Nazi
yeah.
voice. And that's, of course, underscores the importance of our country where many people, you know, there's freedom of speech, and so there's not just one voice that dominates electronic media.
My fear, Lou, is that First Amendment is being curtailed many places today. You know, one of the interesting things, Solzhenitsyn, and another guy, how can you not be a fan? But Solzhenitsyn said, under Stalin, they weren't afraid of guns. They were afraid of radios and Xerox machines. And I thought that was fascinating. They were afraid of radios, and they weren't afraid of somebody having a gun. They were afraid of the Xeroxes and copying machines and radios. Because there was
if people hear only one voice, like I said before a moment ago, if that's the only voice they hear. Over the course of time, no matter what the evidence is, even if it's completely wrong or completely false,
doesn't matter.
If you hear it repeatedly, you start to believe it.
Sure.
And so that's why in the case of Stalin Germany or Hitler, they not only had to seize the radio and the means of communication, they had to make sure that opposing voices did not have access to radio to counter what they were saying. And so this way they could shape people's minds on what's going on and what they think.
I'm going to take a turn around. We'll come back, and I'm going to talk about the other great time, the rise of Joe McCarthy. And I've read tons of stuff about that and Murrow's role in all of that. And I read Fred Friendly's book about it. But what a chilling time. And we now have these far leftists who witch hunt in the media today. And I wonder, Lou Paper is here. Honest to God, you guys, I think it's his third or fourth book. His website, St. Martin's Press, is his publisher on this book, Empire, William Paley and the Making of CBS. Twin Aspen Dental is open. Need some specialty work to make your smile beautiful. You need a family dental clinic for your checkups and cleanings. Comes Brian Richter, my daughters, my sons, all of us, pandemic or not. Keeping patients and employees in the community safe is a top priority. They treat every patient as if they're infectious, maintain top-notch infection control protocols. If you like to experience the same quality of care, believe me, it's there. And be confident in your smile. New patients today, everybody gets free teeth whitening for life. Say it again, free teeth whitening for life. Become a patient of Dr. Richter. So what? There's a pandemic. Your teeth, you got cavities and all kinds of stuff happens. And want to have white teeth, call them at 303-841-7466, 303-841-7466. On the web, TwinAspenDentalCenter.com, 303-841-7466, TwinAspenDentalCenter.com.
Listen live at radio.com. This is the Peter Boyles Show.
Morning, everybody. 28 after the hour of 8 o'clock, 8:28 on a Thursday morning. Back here tomorrow morning at 5. Stefan at 3. Wonderful guest with us. A season for giving thanks. And I saw Dr. McCallum Monday. And she'll change your life. What a great gift to give to yourself. Focus on making the most of the rest of your life. Dr. Julie McCallum, the doctors at Cenogenics, can help. Getting older certainly is a challenge, don't I know? But taking care of your body, you can move through older years feeling the top of your game. Julie McCallum's my pal. I mean, a team that can help you get your metabolism and hormones balanced and healthy, create programs especially for you, help you focus, become stronger, feel in control of your life again. Call today. Begin your journey back to health. The team at Cenogenics, you call Jackie. Here's the phone number, 720-387-3681, 720-387-3681. And Jackie answers the phone, and you get the free 20-minute phone call with Dr. McCallum. They arrange times and days, and just do it right. She will change your life. Denver.Cenogenics.com, Denver.Cenogenics.com. Call today. Get your life back. He's become a true favorite of the show. Lou Paper is with us. His book, Empire, William S. Paley and the Making of CBS. St. Martin's is his publisher. His website is Lou Paper, LEWPAPER. So we're talking about Murrow and what's called Murrow's Boys and Cronkite and all these guys. But then up comes Senator Joe McCarthy. And I mean, I've read much about UAC and Joe McCarthy and who they went after. And you actually talked about red channels. It's been a long, long time since I read anything about red channels. I'll turn it over to you, Lou, if you would talk, please.
Well, you know, when McCarthy came, I hate to say to power, when McCarthy started his spewing these comments in 1950 about communists and government, and he started talking, making these allegations, which in almost every case had no basis in fact, where he alleged that, as I say, there were communists embedded in the State Department and elsewhere in the government. And people went along with it because in 1950s, it's hard to think about it now, but people were very scared, frightened by communism and by Russia and the Soviet Union. And there was this fervor that we were going to become engaged in war with Russia. And so McCarthy seized upon that and tried to exploit the public fears and make these allegations. It's hard to know exactly why, but I think he did it in part to get attention to himself and enhance his own political stature.
Maybe slipping.
But what happened is, as it went on, people in the media and started to question whether they should say something. And Murrow had a program on CBS, which many of your listeners may remember, called See It Now, mm-hmm. in which he would interview people and address, in some cases, he would talk to celebrities like Marilyn Monroe, mm-hmm. But he also used it to address political issues. And Murrow used in 1954, Murrow began to use the program, See It Now, to address some of the allegations that McCarthy was making. And one of the key allegations that he did was there was a brigadier general whom McCarthy had, it was a World War II hero, mm-hmm. who McCarthy had attacked as a guy named Ralph Zwicker, mm-hmm. who McCarthy had attacked as being a communist. And I guess that was a breaking point for Murrow. He decided to address it head on to show that McCarthy's allegations had no basis in fact. And you got to remember now, TV was now dominant, and CBS was a premier network for news. And Murrow was a real celebrity and a very well-known figure by then on television. And so that was a telling moment. The irony, talking about Bill Paley, did not like controversy. And when he and Murrow would talk about it, Murrow would ask him. And Murrow and Paley had been friends for a long time. But when Murrow would ask him whether he should go ahead and do this, Paley would say, well, you can go ahead and do this, but I don't like having this stomach ache every time you get up there to talk about these issues. Because, like I said, Paley was not one who wanted any controversy.
No. Our guest is Lou Paper. I've read books about Murrow, and I read Fred Friendly's book. Murrow was, by a lot of discussions, he was a depressant. He had all kinds of emotional issues, but he had a lot of stones. And when they decide to take on Joe McCarthy, and it's like, in many ways, I think, as history is so repetitive, we're watching the politically correct weed and seed through the media, particularly in talk radio, and getting people fired for real, you know, for they perceive a reason and say this guy's clearly a racist or he's a this or that, and they get rid of people. They really get rid of them. And the corporations that run the radio business or TV are so frightened that they have to get rid of these people because they're afraid of the next turn. And in McCarthyism, and you brought up red channels. I'd totally forgotten red channels. The people's lives were destroyed in this business by a rumor, by a charge. And it's almost right. This French existentialism, Sartre or Camus stuff that you could just charge somebody. Talk about that.
Well, you know, people, that's right, because I go back, to put it in context, people were very frightened of Russia. They were frightened of communism. And so if somebody was alleged to be a communist or a communist sympathizer, people took that to heart. People didn't always worry about whether the allegation was true. And then for people who owned radio stations or television stations, like Paley did, they, you know, this was a mass medium. And so they depended upon advertisers who were selling products to and services to the entire country. And they didn't want to offend any advertiser who would then leave the network, and then the network would lose an important source of income. So that's why Paley didn't like controversy. He didn't want anything that might disrupt the income stream that CBS had. And so that was always a guiding light for him. He was always looking out first. He wanted to have news, and he wanted to be first in news. But he also wanted to make sure, first and foremost, that CBS was financially successful.
But I didn't know until I read you, and, you know, I'm sure everybody's dad watched Ed Sullivan on Sunday night. But Sullivan background checked. I didn't know that, that through the, you know, outfits like Red Channels or whoever. But if you were going to be, well, you talked to it, you wrote it, that if you're going to be on Sullivan's show, then what?
Well, you had to be cleared, so to speak. So Red Channels was a magazine that and a group that verified whether somebody was or was not a communist or communist sympathizer.
Yeah, right.
And the last thing you would want to do, like, say, for example, Ed Sullivan, who had this very popular program, which also made a lot of money for CBS, the last thing you would want to do was have somebody on your program who was later identified as a communist sympathizer or a communist, regardless of whether it was true or not.
Didn't
because,
matter.
Again, just merely making the allegation might be enough for people to turn stop watching the program and might be enough for advertisers to or companies to stop advertising on the program.
You see, I mean, I see it today in spades. I see people's lives being destroyed in our business because they allege something or somebody said something. And one of the interesting people that I've read this about is you write about Lucille Ball and Paley. But Lucille Ball's father was a Trotskyist. Do you ever read this stuff about she used to go to the meetings? And so they got down to it, and they were tracking Lucille Ball. And Desi, who I have, like, I got a mixed thing about Desi. But Desi did that great speech. The only thing read about Lucy is her hair. And she was saved. But the same witch hunters were after Lucille Ball. And she clearly, she had this, you know, active Socialist Workers Party Trotskyist for a granddad who helped raise her. Must have been a hell of a guy. And they used to go to the meetings, CP meetings. And they were going to get her.
Yeah, they were after everybody. And in fact, Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, I got to remember, they had one of the most popular programs on CBS, you know, I Love Lucy. And that was an incredibly popular program. And so the last thing Paley wanted to do was to see that program disappear. But and she, they had to go to New York, Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, they had to go to New York and explain to Paley why these allegations had no basis in fact. And ultimately, Paley accepted the explanation, and the crisis, you know, was averted. But that's the kind of thing where just merely making the allegation about some family member might be enough to scare people away.
What's the politically correct? Witch hunters do it now, to academia, to the media, to sports, to, I mean, it's so frightening because it's so repetitive. Ultimately, what happens between Murrow and McCarthy? What ultimately happens?
Well, ultimately, of course, you know, Murrow challenged him and showed that these allegations that McCarthy was making were based on lies.
Yeah.
And he had this very famous line at the end of this program about, you know, this guy, this Brigadier General. And he quoted and said, the fault from Sue, I don't know if I got the word exactly right, but the fault, dear Brutus, does not lie in our stars, it lies in ourselves.
Yes.
And what he was trying to say, Murrow was trying to say that these people, McCarthy and people like this, were able to succeed because we were willing to go, the people were willing to go along with it without determining whether or not there was any truth to it.
And I say that about today. What we're watching today is the same thing as brave guys. And Murrow, do whatever you want to do with Murrow. But Murrow's brave.
He was. But ultimately they had he and Paley had a breaking off, yep, because Murrow wanted to continue to pursue these things. And like I said, Paley, he wanted to support, in theory, he wanted to support Murrow, but he, as he always said to him, I like and I want to support what you're doing, but I don't like the stomach ache that comes with it.
Yeah. What was it?
And so.
In the end, Murrow sees a game show coming, and that's a powerful part. I've read that before. Talk about the ending of Murrow and the beginning of the game show.
Well, what happened was the game shows came on, and of course, again, I go back to what I said mentioned before. Paley's focus was making sure that CBS was financially successful, and so what happened ultimately was that the game shows took over, and it supplanted the focus on the news and was able to make money for CBS in a way that the news had once made money for CBS. And so the shift was there. And so that's what happened.
Tell the story before we break about Jackie Gleason passing out or going to sleep. I'd never read that before. It's a great story. Tell the story, please.
Oh, yeah, that was, Jackie Gleason, of course, was originally on the Dumont network, which nobody remembers the Dumont network, but he was a very funny guy, and again, CBS recruited him, and so they had this negotiating strategy, and they were going back and forth, and Gleason was there with his agent, with Paley and his folks, and they were talking about how much money.
We still got you? We lose you? We lose him? You still there, Lou? We got you? Ah, Billy. When we break, I'll just kill that off. You break, because the story's great, and I don't want to kill the story. Groundbreaking advanced FUE treatment from Advanced Hair Restoration is finally here in Denver. Truly, it works. If you're receding, especially young men, middle-aged guys, receding hairlines, bald spots, thinning hair, come to the end, we can change it. I met with Dr. Pauls. She's the best. She's the surgeon and Farah and the team. And I say this all the time. The whole thing's run by women. I mean, it's like, and it's so private and confidential and safe. The advanced FUE treatment takes it one day. It's pain-free. Get your new hair started growing the very next day. It's 100% guaranteed to work. Advanced hair. You get all the very highest standards of care, well beyond CDC guidelines. Celebrating Advanced Hair's grand opening in Denver. Special deal, $250 off and $250 free hair grafts. $250 off, $250 free hair grafts. If you even have a question, and, you know, it's all confidential, it's very private, 720-459-HAIR. 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 One-day treatment, life-changing results. Your new hair 100% guaranteed to grow. Private, confidential, simply a question. Ask it. 720-459-HAIR. 720-459-HAIR or visit advancedhair.com.
Listen live at radio.com. When radio counts, count on Peter Boyle.
8:49, it's 11 minutes before 9. Stephan this afternoon, Peter Boyle, 710 KNUS. Again, Lou Paper, and it's P-A-P-E-R, historian, the book Empire. Go to his website, loupaper.com. Tremendous reads. Tell the Gleason story, and then we lost our line. But then wrap it up on all of the what is this really truly about in terms of where we are in the media today? But finish the Gleason story, please. Do we have him up, Bill? Billy, do we lose him? Do we have
him?
Can you
hear me?
Yeah, there you are. Okay. Tell the Gleason story.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you now, Lou. Go ahead.
So Gleason was, this is the early 1950s, and Jackie Gleason was a star performer on the Dumont television network. And so Paley wanted to bring him on to the CBS network. And so they had a meeting at CBS offices in Black Rock in Manhattan on 52nd Street early in the morning. And Gleason was a big drinker. And so he had been out on the town the night before. And there they were. They were sitting in Paley's office, Paley and his lieutenants, and Gleason and his agent. And Gleason was demanding a lot of money, and Paley did not want to pay the money Gleason wanted. And in the middle of the meeting, while Paley was explaining why he would not pay Gleason what he wanted, Gleason fell asleep. And Paley looked over at Gleason and said, well, if that's how he feels about it, we might as well give him the money.
Yeah, that was great. And then you spend so much time when All in the Family comes on and how the network changes. What, I mean, the guy's remarkable. We got about 5 or 6 minutes here. What a remarkable life. We didn't talk about Babe Paley. We didn't talk about his kids and his kids, and they have falling outs. But why does all of this work, and how does it work, and how much of it? I mean, we didn't even talk about David Sarnoff. But all of those guys made all of this come together, did they not?
They did. And I guess the thing is, one thing I would remark about Paley, like I said, he had a single-minded devotion to CBS and its financial success. But the one good thing about Paley was he recognized that in order to succeed, it was important for him to have people around him who were smarter than him and who knew better than him that he could rely on to make the decisions that would make the network successful. And I think a paradigm story, and I'll finish with this, is in the 70s, as Paley's getting older, and he's the CEO of the company, and Bob Daley, who later became president of Warner Brothers, Bob Daley is the head of the CBS's, he was the head of CBS, the network, in terms of the programs, the entertainment programs that CBS put on. And they have a room where they have these boards that they put on, where they have a schedule for the TV, the network for entertainment. And Daley's in charge of that. And Paley walks into the room where Daley's having a meeting with his staff. And Bill Paley looks at the board where they have these slots for the different programs and what's going to be where. And Paley starts walking over to it to change things. And Daley says to him, don't touch it. He says, I'm in charge here, and this is what we're going to do. If you don't like it, if it's not successful, if you don't like it, fire me, but leave it alone. And Paley loved that because he liked people like Daley who would take responsibility and who would try and make the network a success. And I think a lot of Paley's success reflected his willingness to rely on people. At the same time, when they didn't perform, he did fire them.
Yeah. This is a question I really thought, because of all the different people you've written about, did you like Paley? I mean, when you said and done, you know, you can write about people and not like them, but did you like Paley?
Yes, I did like Bill Paley. I thought he was certainly a very charming guy. As I said, he had a single-minded devotion to CBS. Did he do everything right? No, nobody does. And he had a reputation for being very ruthless when it came to people. And a lot of people complained about being fired, abruptly.
The music just started. We're going to get you back on the Kennedy assassination date because I know you've done that book as well. It's Lou Paper, everyone. Empire's the book. You know what? I'm glad I met you. Give me a whole lot of days of reading. I'll put you on hold. I'll speak to you on Kennedy Assassination Day. Fair enough?
Okay, sounds good.
Thanks, Lou.
Sounds good.
Thank you. All right, everybody. That is it. See you tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. We'll do it again. Stefan, this afternoon. Question is, how will this end? President Trump or President Biden? It has to come to a head soon. Billy Thorpe, great job. Thanks, everybody. See you tomorrow morning at 5 a.m., 710 KNUS.
Happy trails to you. Till we meet again.
Yes.